Hello. So today we are doing explainability and accountability. And we'll be talking a little bit about what it means to explain the artificial intelligence functioning, how it works, and why that's important in human terms. And we will also be noting this as the beginning of our third set of artificial intelligence principles. So we said we recall that there are first those principles which are about me or you or the individual. These are dignity, privacy, and autonomy. And then we said there are the ethics of us, fairness, solidarity, equity, and social well-being. Now we're talking about the ethics of the machine, and explainability is perhaps the most important of those. And again, it's the question of how do we know? Do we know, and do we want to know how the machines actually work? And so here is a very pithy, but I think a nicely revealing tweet or X. I'm not sure what the tweets are still called now that it's X. They're still called tweets. I don't know. Anyway, suppose you have cancer and you have to choose between a black box AI surgeon that cannot explain how it works, but it has a 90% cure rate, and a human surgeon with an 80% cure rate. So what's going on here? I think if you take this seriously, that is, you imagine that you really have cancer and you're going to the hospital and they actually offer you these options, your first thought, certainly my first thought would be, well, I mean, I will just go with the one that has the higher cure rate, right? I mean, in this case, you want performance. You want a better chance to live. Makes sense. But consider, I mean, when they say that they don't know how the machine works, that means that 10% of the time that things go wrong, we have no idea why they go wrong. And there might be some kinds of mistakes that the machine makes that a human would not make. Right? And so, for example, we see this very clearly in the kinds of accidents that you sometimes see on YouTube videos, the problems, let's say, that driverless cars encounter. They seem to be driving just fine, and then there's something on the road like a cone off to the side, but that's enough to completely befuddle the car, and it doesn't know what to do, and it just sits there in front of the cone while everyone is honking behind and that kind of thing, instead of just doing what a human would do, which is just drive slightly around and continue on the way. So the point is about the computer versus human, a comparison, it's not just that there is a better cure rate for the computer. It's also the things that are cured, or the way that the curing happens, or the hits and misses, so to speak. Now, the computer might miss some things which are easy, even while on the other hand, it might accomplish some things that are hard for humans. For example, it's hard for humans to be at 100% every day. Even cancer surgeons have bad days. Professors have bad days. There are days when I'm lecturing and I feel like I'm talking and talking and talking. At the end of 15 minutes, even I don't understand what I have just said. It happens, right? Computers don't have that problem, in the sense that they perform at the level they are able to perform consistently, assuming the power doesn't go out or something crazy like that. So you have a very different kind of profile of error. Like, the kind of thing that will go wrong if the cancer treatment fails is very different. For humans, they might have a good day, they might have a bad day, or there might be things that are just too challenging for them. For a computer, what could go wrong is much more the unknown or the unanticipated. It's much more the kind of freakish oddity which a human manages easily, like the cone in the road, which they just drive around and it befuddles the Tesla. For the computer, the kinds of problems that tend to occur, as I say, they're the kinds of things that break the computer down, are just simple but slight irregularities. Frequently, it's things that humans handle easily, but a computer is just not familiar to its training data. And because the computer can't think, because it can't make connections between its past experience and new experiences, which are slightly different, the computer just breaks down. So it's not just that there's a difference in the percentages of how well the computer performs versus the human. there's a difference in the kinds of errors that get made. There's also, secondly, an important question to ask about whether you want to understand your own health and your own body. Some people might say, look, I'm willing to take the lower rate just so that I can have a real human doctor explain to me what this surgery is going to be like, what the potential problems are, what risks exist, why he or she thinks this will be successful, and so on. Maybe in order to get those kinds of human benefits, the kind of intellectual confidence that I am being treated with respect and that my life is worth having and that people on this team are trying to do everything for me, maybe I am willing to trade a little bit of final outcome in order to have that human support in this life-threatening kind of situation. So it's not just, right, that there's this difference in cure rates. There's this human background that has to do, in some sense, with the fact that the computer can't explain itself. It just acts. It might act well, it might act poorly, but it has no way of communicating with the patient. It just does what it does, even if it does it really well. And so the question is, those human things, when you have a human surgeon, are they worth anything at all? And if they are worth something, how much is that? And then you can go from there. So you might say, so let's make this concrete. You might say, look, if it's between 90% and 80%, and I'll just speak for myself, I would take the machine. You know, if the machine can't explain what's happening, so be it. That 10%, that's 1 out of 10. That's a big difference. I will take the machine for sure. But if you get to, say, 88, 89%, right, where it's 1 out of 100, 1 out of 50, where there's not much difference, I'm at least going to think about it. I'm at least going to say, you know what? I might be willing to give away just a slight bit of potential, maybe 1 out of 100 in my case. I might give up 1 out of 100 to have the benefit of having a human doctor explain to me why he or she is going to be doing what he or she is going to do, and why we might think that this will be successful. So that's the question of explainability. And what we're trying to get at here is the sense of what it is worth as human beings to, in some sense, understand what is happening to us, or why specific things are happening. Why is the machine doing what it's doing in response to this terrible disease? 90, 80, that seems like a big difference to me. I'm curious to hear what you think. Some people, of course, I use this frequently. Many people, and it makes perfect sense to me, many people believe, you know, the explainability, that sounds nice, but when my life is at stake, forget it. If I can get 90% machine, 89% human, I'm still going machine. Some people even say, look, if it's 90-90, humans have bad days. At least the machine is not going to get drunk the night before, right? So maybe I would still go for the machine, even if it's 90-90. And that's accepting the fact that I don't know why the machine is doing what it's doing, or it can't. I'm accepting the fact that it can't explain exactly how it comes to the decision to make the maneuvers it does with these sharp knives called scalpels, right? Or whatever else it's doing in my body. In any case, what we're trying to get to is, or what we're trying to get at is this idea of explainability, understanding why things are happening. And we're trying to get to that as an ethical value, as something that is worth having on its own. And what we're trying to do here is, in a sense, quantify that. I mean, how much of our own lives will we give up? 1%? 0%? To understand why things are happening. And there are different answers. Here's another example. This example is more realistic because artificial intelligence is actually used now in finance to help banks and other institutions make decisions about loans and other kinds of financial decisions. Of course, it's also used in quick stock buying and selling. There's just that quant trading or quantified trading is about artificial intelligence making decisions. That's different, though. That's not a life and death situation, or even a specifically human kind of situation. That's just traders going back and forth and trying to make money off each other. The question here is more human. She is posing this question about a bank making a loan decision, and I think it's a mortgage loan decision, though I'm not sure. Frequently, AI is used in that context to help bankers make mortgage decisions. And the choice here is, it's a big difference in accuracy. 75% for the human, 90% for the machine. But again, the machine can't tell you why it accepts or rejects a loan application. So if I make a loan application to buy a home, to Bank of America, and Bank of America says, you know what, Bruce Hill, we're not going to give you this loan. Usually they will be able to tell me it's because we look back at your credit card history and we notice that you frequently forget to pay your credit cards. So if you're not paying your credit cards, we're not going to give you a loan to buy a home. Now, I might say, well, it's not my fault. The dog ate the check or what have you. But at least there is an explanation. Right? I understand why Bank of America refused my loan. And then there's some actionable response I can take. I can say, okay, now from now on, I'm really going to make sure that I pay all my credit cards on time every month. And maybe after a year of this, I can go back to Bank of America and they say, okay, yeah, you look pretty good now. So here's the loan, right? So this is the advantage of dealing with a human that can explain why a decision is made about a loan. Whereas by contrast, what's being proposed here is this idea that, well, the bank could also use this machine that produces a yes, no, but it doesn't tell you why, right? It doesn't explain what is responsible for either accepting the loan or application or rejecting the loan application. So you can see in real life, this is a case where the explainability really makes it, and we're going to talk about this later under the idea of interpretability, but you can see just immediately here on the superficial level, this is an area where the value of explainability is very palpable. It's not just that as a dignified human being, I like to know why I am receiving the treatment I am. It's beyond that. If I understand why I am receiving the treatment I am, I can actually respond to it, maybe correct my behavior, pay my credit cards, and then I end up getting a loan, right? So there's a real palpable, tangible benefit to being able to explain why a decision is being made. And again, we can imagine, and these do exist, highly complicated and advanced artificial intelligence agents that are taking in massive amounts of data, processing a loan application through those massive amounts of data, seeking correspondences with other applications and loans that are similar to yours in certain ways, and to see whether those loans were successful or failures. And then from all those correspondences, essentially making a decision about whether yours will be a success or failure and issuing a decision. Those machines, they are in use. They do work. But all they can produce for you at the end is a yes or no. They can't tell you why. And so the question she's asking here is, if you are a top executive in finance, so she's asking this to bankers, and you have this choice, the 90 versus 75, 90% accuracy for the AI that is not explainable, or 75% accuracy for the human that does make a coherent decision, says, look, doesn't pay the credit cards, therefore no loan. What do you do? And she gives four choices. Number one is yes, there's a great track record and is used by the computer, by the competitors. That's the AI version, the 90%. Yes, the algorithm is accurate and most clients will not ask. Okay, so here she's saying, look, maybe it's true that a human can give this explainable answer, but human clients really don't care. All human clients want is the yes or no. That's another way of saying that for human beings, maybe we don't care about explainability. It doesn't really matter to us why or how the machine makes its decision. We only care about whether that decision is accurate. If the machine is making accurate decisions or better decisions than human makes. Why? Who cares? Right? That's a possible response. Then the third response she gives is, no, our clients have a right to an explanation. Right? And so that's just the converse idea. It's the idea that there is some ethical value to an explanation. And I think there she means to go beyond the idea, the practical idea, that the explanation helps you solve the problem because I will start to pay my credit cards now and then get a loan. It's more than that. It's much more like the notion of surgery, where there is some human value or some dignity value in the sensation that this team of doctors or this team of bankers, that they're treating me as a human, and in some sense they want me to. It's not just that they want me to succeed, it's that they do want to take me, they want to respect me. Put it that way. They want to respect me as a human client, and they feel that part of respecting me is explaining why certain things are happening to me, like getting denied for the loan. And four, no, I don't want to be accountable for any unlikely mistakes of the algorithm. So what's being said here, this is an interesting and distinct point. What's going on here is a little bit like the example I raised in the last case with the cone in the road that stops the Tesla. Even though a machine is 90% accurate, it's still 10% inaccurate. And if that's right, if it's 10% inaccurate, then there are these mistakes that it gets made. That is, these are 10% of the applicants who should get a loan and, let's say, would repay that loan, but the machine says no, maybe later on, and some newer technology emerges that gives a better reading from the same data and corrects the error the machine made earlier, but now it's 10 years down the road and I missed my chance to buy the home. Now maybe I can come back and I can sue the bank. I can say, look, you guys should have given me that loan. We can see with this new technology that I should have been approved. So maybe here there's this question of accountability. We're going to talk about this later. But there's this question about whether or not the bank should be held liable for wrong decisions about granting loans. Maybe yes, maybe no. And if they are supposed to be held liable for wrong decisions, how that intersects with the fact that with an AI, a wrong decision, at least initially, can't be explained. Whereas with a human being, if a human being makes the wrong decision, let's say I'm a loan officer and I tell you, Stephen Smith, that your loan is denied, and you, Stephen Smith, ask me why, and I say, well, you never pay your credit cards. And then you say to me, I always pay my credit cards. And I look back and I say, oh, look, my bad. I was not looking at your file. I was looking at John Smith's file, not yours, right? So there is this idea that if you can explain why a decision is made, the decision can be corrected, and that tends to work pretty well when humans make a decision. Humans can just go back and check their work. With computers, not necessarily. Okay, so that's two cases which I think gather up several senses in which there is a human value to explainability in artificial intelligence and information technology. There is a human value, or a set of human values that you can attribute to the fact that a machine can be, the decision a machine makes and how it makes that decision, that those things can be explained. If they can be explained, right? So I'm saying if they can be explained, right? So that's established as a fact. I don't mean that machines can all be explained. They frequently cannot be. But if they can be explained and that fact exists, then extending out of that fact, there is some human value. People are respected when they understand why a decision was made against them or for them. And that would go for whether we are talking about a loan application or healthcare operating on surgery, or maybe even something more trivial like how it is Netflix decides which movies to send to me. Well, this is another area of intense debate, right? You would say, look, maybe with respect, it might be that with respect to Netflix and movie recommendations, maybe I am more willing to say, I don't care so much about explainability, just give me a good movie, right? Because in that case, if I end up getting a bad movie, it really doesn't matter too much. I mean, I could just scroll myself through the set of possibilities. So maybe too, there's an angle here, or there's an aspect of this discussion which has to do with how serious the AI decision is. So maybe explainability is more important, or it has more human value for something like surgery than it does for something like loan applications. And it has more weight or more human value for loan applications than it has for Netflix. This is basically the current European Union approach to AI ethics. They have some, it's a form of that. They have something called a sort of risk scale. So things they call high risk fall into one category of AI human governance, and things that are low risk fall into another category. High risk would be artificial intelligence used for healthcare. That's obviously high risk, at least for things like cancer surgery. Maybe not for cosmetic things, but for cancer surgery, that's high risk because lives are at stake. So that's one set of rules is in play there. And those rules, this is still under consideration, but those rules might include some kind of requirements that the machine be at least to some degree explainable, because guaranteeing the dignity of the patients requires that they have some understanding, at least, of why the machine does what it does. Whereas by contrast, according to the current EU idea of risk, of the dispersal of ethical rules across a risk continuum, we're on the side of very low risk, something like Netflix, where if the computer is wrong, who cares? So on that front, then the rules requiring explainability in AI may be relaxed, because we just don't care very much about that. We just want a good movie and hope for the best. So that's an overall look at the human value of explainability and why we want, at least if everything else is even, I think most of us would agree that there is a value, and we do want the machine to be explainable. We want to understand why and how the machine came to the determination that it did. As I say, once you start trading accuracy or performance for explainability, then you've got questions. But if you've got the same accuracy, the same performance, then at least in that case, I think most of us agree, we prefer to have an understanding of why, at least in healthcare and things like that. So that's the in these sessions, what we always try and do is we always try and talk about the human experience first of explainability, and then we move on to the more theoretical definitions. We can look at ChatGPT's definition. We can look at then explainability, the theory of explainability, and then we will talk about the practice of explainability. You see here, I've gotten in the habit now of asking ChatGPT to depict an image of these ideas. So here I asked it to depict the concept of explainability in AI with an image. This is what it gave us. You can see the machine is unable to explain explainability, unable to spell explainability, which certainly casts some doubt upon the accuracy or the legitimacy of this representation of explainability, right? It shows in some sense how it's a very good example of how the kinds of errors that machines make they're just zany. I mean, how is it possible the machine can generate all this highly sophisticated stuff, these representations of what, five people that look pretty much like people? That's pretty amazing that it just generates those people, and then it generates a picture of a robot, and that's good. And it gets those three-dimensional spaces. It catches the idea that explaining something maybe has a whiteboard, and catches the idea that you use graphs and so on. So this is a really sophisticated picture. It does capture in many ways what the idea of explainability in AI is. But at the same time that it does all that very sophisticated stuff, it also gets wrong this incredibly simple thing. All the computer needs to do to write explainability correctly on the whiteboard is just copy-paste the word that I already put in the prompt. But it couldn't do that. I mean, the simplest part of the task, it failed. So that's why computers can be so frustrating, and that's why people are very interested in the idea of explainability, because the kinds of errors the computers make, they just seem crazy to us frequently. And we just can't understand how it can do so well on everything else and then get the simplest part wrong. And if there's no explainability in the machine, if it's just this neural network with all these hidden layers and we put stuff in and get stuff out, we don't know what happens in there. You know, we have no way of understanding how to make that simple and just dumb mistake. It just doesn't make sense. Now, think about that with respect to your, just very quickly, think about that with respect to your cancer surgery. So that would be kind of like the equivalent of the machine very perfectly with its scalpels going into your body and far greater skill than a shaking human hand, right, with the perfect stillness of the computer blade going in and in minuscule cuts remove exactly the cancer, nothing more, nothing less, do a job which is far, far superior to the job that a human hand could do, right? So that's the advantage of the AI surgeon. But then after extracting perfectly the cancer, then for some reason we can't understand, it takes the scalpel and jabs it straight into the patient's heart. And something like that, sorry for the image, but something like that is about what is happening here, right? I mean, the computer is doing all this stuff perfectly, better than a human could do, at least in the time. It produced this image in a few seconds. That's infinitely better, almost, than a human illustrator could do in that time, right? At least in that time. The computer really outperforms the human. But then again, when it comes to the simplest part, it does this crazy thing, which almost ruins the entire effect. In medicine, it would be like the computer perfectly slicing out the cancer and then stabbing the heart. That's why explainability is important, because it's true. The way machines perform is they make these mistakes and extremely frustrating. All right. So the definition of explainability. We forgot to do the ChatGPT. Let's ask what ChatGPT says. Explain. Well, let's ask it to explain explainability. In AI ethics in less than 51 words. Let's see what it says. That's pretty good. Explainability in AI ethics. Okay, we've got a winner here. In AI ethics involves making AI decisions understandable and transparent, ensuring users can understand. Users can comprehend and trust AI processes and outcomes. AI decisions involves making it understand. Yeah, okay. I think that's pretty good, actually. What did I write? What was the human? Let's take a look. What was the human? My definition. Describe how and why output was produced in the languages of the various stakeholders. Yeah, okay, I think my definition is a little better. What I'm capturing here, which is a little different, is first, more than the ChatGPT definition, I'm putting an emphasis on exactly how the machine processed to make a decision. Whereas, what does the ChatGPT say? It just says understandable and transparent. Okay, that's fine, understandable and transparent. But I would rather say, tell me why the machine made the decision it did. I think that's a little more penetrating than understandable. And then the second part is also important, in the languages of the various stakeholders. So it's not just ChatGPT says there's just kind of one general idea of explanation. There's one general idea of making the machine understandable. What I'm saying here is that there are multiple, that true explainability requires multiple, in a sense, multiple understandings, or making things understandable in multiple ways. Okay, so that's my formal theoretical definition. Then let's go to the practical definition, and let me explain what I mean by that second part, the various stakeholders. When we talk about the machine being explainable, being able to being transparent, being able to understand why it makes the decisions it does, that means different things for different people. For example, the user of the machine, the developer of the machine, and a lawyer. Those are three very different people. What do they want when they want, when they think, explain the AI? The user wants something called, as I mentioned earlier, interpretability. That is, what is it? It's, as I say below, it's the why without the how. It's like, I don't care exactly how the machine came to the conclusion that the fact that my failure to pay my credit cards means I will not pay the loan. I don't really care about that. What I care about is that the source problem is the fact that I failed to pay my credit cards. That's what I care about, because it allows me to do something about it. It allows me to respond, to fix my situation. So interpretability is the idea that you understand the machine, not so much kind of like a mechanical engineer. You don't understand exactly how the gears fit together and how the decision was made, so much as you understand what the factor was that, or the factors were, that caused the positive or negative outcome. Right? So explainability when you're applying for a loan maybe means, what is it in my behavior in the past that got this rejection, and therefore what can I change in the future to get a loan next year? Right? That's explainability that matters in the case of the bank statement. For the developer, by contrast, I think explainability does mean a little bit more of that how part, right? How do the gears turn? What was it in the way that I designed this machine, say in the way I ordered, the way it managed different tasks? Did it first think about the individual's income and then think about credit history, and then, or is it, should it instead be, first let's filter for credit history, then filter for income? Those are architectural decisions. Those are design decisions. And they affect the way that the machine, the gears in the machine, in a sense, the metaphorical gears, are turning and twisting inside the machine. And for the developer, the AI designer, the engineer, that answers to that question might be more what they seek when they ask about explainability. And then a lawyer, the person who represents the firm, the bank, in this, let's say in this case, that is giving loans or not giving loans, what they want is accountability. When they say explainability, what they mean is, which human being who contributed to this machine? Is it the human being who gathered the data? Is it the human being who designed the AI? Is it the human being who inputted the data of the particular client in a particular case? Which one of these people is the one, if there is one, we'll talk about that later, but which one of these people is the one that got something wrong, assuming something goes wrong with a loan application, and let's say someone who should have gotten a loan is denied the loan? So for the lawyer, explainability in essence means, whose fault is it? And then that's kind of a negative articulation, right? We're assuming that things are going wrong. But of course, things frequently go right. And in that case, you would say, well, the accountability here is, well, who deserves the credit? I mean, who should get a pat on the back, or who should get a raise, or who should get some kind of recognition because the machine succeeded? Which person is accountable for this success? Or again, for this, for a failure. So the idea of explainability in theory is Well, first, the idea of explainability as a human experience is the kind of sensation of dignity that I want to know why things are happening to me. Then the idea of explainability in theory is the ability to describe how and why an output was produced in the language of the various stakeholders. And then in practice, what that means is finding the people who are intersecting with the machine, the users, the designers, the lawyers, and so on, and making sure each of them understands in ways that are significant for them in their work, how the machine is working. And as I say, I think that the big distinction there is the one between the user and the developer. Users, at least in the case of the bank, what they want is interpretability. They want to be able to explain what needs to be changed in order to get a different outcome. The developer, they want to understand what's going on inside. They want to understand how the machine is working so that they can improve accuracy at the end of the day. All right, so why don't we take 5 minutes to sketch the difference between explainability and interpretability. Maybe that's not quite the right way to put it. Let me say explainability generally and the specific case of interpretability. Why don't we think about that for a moment? Okay, so we've talked about the cases of the AI doctor and the AI loan officer. We've described explainability as what the machine did for different audiences. We've defined it and described it. Now we're going to talk about explainability and accountability. And this is very important. Frequently, this ethics principle, when people talk about explainability, frequently they will link it up with accountability. So people will say the principle is explainability and accountability. Or sometimes people will actually say accountability, and by that they mean accountability and explainability. This basically stems from sort of a pessimistic view of the world. It's the idea that we need explainability when the machine goes wrong, but not really when it goes right. we're more worried about punishing people who've done poorly or done bad than we are about rewarding people when they do well. There's kind of that edge to the accountability, which I personally sort of don't like. But be that as it may, frequently when people are talking about accountability and explainability, what they want to do is they want to blame someone for something that has gone wrong. And here is a classic case. Tesla has run over the curb and run into a looks like a restaurant and broken the front door and glass. Hopefully it would appear that there's no injuries here. This is not a human disaster. It's just a financial problem and a little bit of a shock inside. But it's the kind of mistake that these driverless cars make. I mean, a human being has no problem figuring out where the curb is generally. But sometimes a driverless car can get confused. Its cameras, etc., just misunderstand that a curb is a curb and not just more of the parking lot. And then a clear window, you can imagine how the computer, just like a bird, as it flies in the window, the car just keeps going until it hits the wall and quickly understands this is not good, and the car stops. So something like that is what happened here. You have our police officer on the scene and writing up his ticket. The question is, who does he give the ticket to? The question to ask here is, who is at fault for this accident? Now, let's assume that this accident happened while the driverless autopilot function was engaged. If it was just a human being driving, well, then it's just a human, right? But let's assume that this is the autopilot did this, right? The person was in the car, was just there, told the car to go park and was just looking at his phone or something, and the car went to park and ran into the window. Who's to blame? This is a hard case, and I will explain why. It is a hard case because of the way artificial intelligence is now working, and it's not working this way in all the cars, so grant me just a little bit of space here. This is partially true in partially futuristic, but not futuristic like science fiction. It's futuristic, and we're just stepping into this stage. Part of the way that an artificial intelligence driverless car functions is that it learns from its driver. So when that Tesla leaves the Tesla lot and is delivered to its buyer, let's say I bought it, it's delivered to James Brousseau. It is delivered with the capability to be able to drive around pretty well. It makes mistakes, but it drives around pretty well. The Tesla driverless car really does work well. We have Waymo now. Driverless cars are working 24 hours a day in San Francisco and Phoenix and some other locations also, I believe. But these driverless cars are working. They're autonomous. There's no human in the car behind the wheel. The car just goes, and it works most of the time. I received my Tesla, and I put it in driverless mode, and it drives around. But also sometimes with the driverless car, sometimes the human driver wants to drive. One reason for that is that the autonomous driving is usually quite conservative. It's safe, it was supposed to be, but it's pretty slow. And if you've ever driven in a Tesla autopilot, you know that it can be a little bit frustrating because the car is always you're always Mr. Safe, right? You never pass unless there's absolutely 5 miles of room in front or behind and everything. So it can be a little bit frustrating. Certainly me at least, and I think most people who drive these cars occasionally say, look, I'm just going to drive this thing. I've got to get to where I'm going. I can't sit around here driving behind grandma 25 miles an hour. I'm going to pass her. Am I technically legally allowed to pass on this residential street? No, I'm not. But grandma in front of me is driving at 15 miles an hour. There's not a car in sight. I'm going to pass. Right? So I take control and I do that. What happens is the Tesla part of, or the AI driving function, part of what it does is it learns from human behavior, or it gets feedback in action from its actions as a result of the human response to it. So, for example, if the car is going too fast and you hit the brakes, it'll learn to slow down. If the car is going too slow and you speed up, it will learn to speed up. If you do things like drive, if you're kind of a tailgating, if you're kind of a tailgating driver and you tend to drive very close to the car in front of you, the AI will learn from your behavior. It learns from how you turn, how close you drive to others, the speeds you go, how quickly you accelerate. The machine records all those things as you, the human driver, operate and uses that information to further perfect and refine the way it acts when it is driving. So when you have an accident like this, given everything I've just said, it is really, really, really difficult to figure out who is to blame for what the car did. Because on the one hand, you could blame the person who designed the artificial intelligence somewhere in Mountain View, California, or Austin, Texas, or wherever it is. Someone designed that AI initially, and maybe that's the person you blame for this accident. Secondly, you might say, look, regardless of who designed it, the people who sold the car, that's the Tesla Motor Company. So, who cares about the AI designer? It's the company that sold the car that is responsible for this accident. Third, someone might say, well, wait a minute now. The car was fine. But the problem is that Brousseau, the driver who bought the car, he kept passing people like grandma and stuff. And so the car learned from my driving to behave somewhat recklessly. And it was my driving that taught the AI, or that refined, let's say, the AI's own driving practices. It was my driving that adjusted the weightings just enough in the car to cause it to have this kind of accident. So who do you blame in that case? Do you blame me, the person whose driving has been training the car? Do you believe the person who sold the car? Do you blame the person who sold the car? Or do you blame the person who designed the AI originally? Now, that question could be answered very easily, perhaps, if we could understand how exactly the AI made its decisions, right? If we could go back into the machine and see a little line where it said, the car, you can imagine this hypothetically, the car says, normally I would stop here, but because my owner, Brousseau, constantly accelerates in this situation, I will accelerate too. Right? And then you have the accident. Well, I mean, if you could find that in the machine, then you would know to blame me. But that's not the way it works. We don't know how the machine, the AI, is being changed by the human driver. And then when an accident like this happens, we don't know if it's a result of the way the AI was originally programmed, or if it's the result of this new incremental changes that were made in the technology by my driving practices. If we don't have any explainability, if we don't have any way of knowing how the machine made the decision it did, then there's no way to know who to blame. The officer can write up his ticket, but there's no way for him to know who to give it to. It's impossible. If it's just a normal car, it's easy. Give it to the driver. But if it's an autopilot car in autopilot function, so the problem or the connection between explainability and accountability is that the the absence of explainability is not just sort of a dignity problem for human beings. There's also a problem for dignity in the sense of people being held responsible for their actions. It's hard to hold someone accountable for something when you don't know why it happened. So that's the big overview. Now I have for you here a real case. And so we've been talking about hypothetical cases and general ideas, but here's a real case I really worked on: real doctors, real patients, real disease, real explainability problem. This is the picture you're looking at is an image, an enhanced image of a skin lesion that is sort of a mark on your skin. And one of the things that AI is very good at is, and I've commented about this in the past in this seminar, one of the things that AI is very good at is looking at images of skin and determining whether or not that image or that blemish is cancer or not. In fact, AI frequently can do that better than human doctors. So, not surprisingly, people are using artificial intelligence to make these diagnoses. Problem. What happens if we can't understand how the machine made its decision? Well, one thing that happens is if the machine makes a misdiagnosis, it says something is not skin cancer, but it is, and then it turns out later that the patient, in fact, did have skin cancer and perhaps dies because it was not correctly diagnosed, there's no way to go back and look and say, well, this is why the mistake was made. And so it makes the doctor who's using this artificial intelligence, it makes the doctor look like a complete fool, right? The doctor's essentially backed into a situation of saying that, well, I made this misdiagnosis just because the machine told me. If you're in that kind of situation where the machine can't explain why it's doing what it's doing, and you're a doctor, and it tells you something is not cancer, that has to worry you a little bit, right? Because if you're wrong, and then you get sued later on or just blamed later on, I mean, your only defense is to say, well, I just blindly did what the machine said. That's pretty weak, right? That's very, especially given how much doctors are paid, medical doctors are paid. And that's really weak. We expect from doctors and all this money they're receiving, you know, that they're going to be able, if they get it wrong, they can at least explain why they got it wrong. They can at least defend themselves. And then that's just lamentable if the doctor steps up and says, well, I don't know why it's wrong. That's what the machine told me. Well, why, doctor, are you even there then? We don't need you if you're not going to be able to explain what's going wrong. So for that reason, many doctors are very hesitant to use this technology, even though, and this goes back to the very first case, even though the technology might provide better diagnostic accuracy than the human doctor, They don't want to use it because they don't want to get caught in that one outlier situation where the machine says it's not cancer, and it is, and the patient dies, and then everyone comes back and says to the doctor, well, where were you on this? What happened out there? So in the real world, there is a problem. The problem is that we have technology that will save lives. We use this technology to evaluate, diagnose skin lesions. Lives will be saved. But doctors don't want to use that technology because they can't understand why it's making the decisions it is, and that opens them, makes them vulnerable to this problem later on if the diagnosis is wrong. So what is the solution? I think that's a pretty clear statement of the problem, right? The problem is we can save lives, but we're not using it because of the explainability problem. It seems like there are three solutions. One, we can do what they were doing. This case took place in Germany, in Frankfurt, I believe. you can just eliminate the machine. That's what they were doing. The doctors are saying, look, the machine is great, but I'm not going to use it because I can't explain it. Sorry. So that solves the problem, right? Now you don't have to worry about it anymore because you don't even have the machine. The other extreme response is you can just eliminate the human. You could, for example, make a law that says when artificial intelligence diagnoses of skin cancer or anything reaches a percentage of accuracy, which is, say, 10% or greater than a human, then we could make a law that says the human just has to accept the AI. That's it. There's just no choice. And maybe doctors might even want that, right? Doctors might all get together and say, look, I want to accept the AI diagnosis when there's a disagreement between what I think and what the AI thinks, because yeah, the AI is better. I want to accept that. But I need some protection, and maybe law can afford that. If law just says, look, you're forced to accept the AI, then maybe the doctor says, you know, that's better. So now I just will follow the AI recommendation, do what the AI says, and if later on the diagnosis is wrong, now I, as a doctor, I'm protected, right? I was just following the law. So that would be another way of solving the problem. You just say the doctors don't have a choice. They have to follow the AI. And there is kind of a precedent for this in cars. When cars, this is quite some time ago, but when cars first started to attain speeds where people were really being hurt in traffic accidents, it made a lot of sense for people to put seatbelts in the cars, kept people safer. But no car company wanted to put seatbelts in the cars initially because they were afraid that it would make their car look unsafe. Right? They said, look, if I'm the first car company to put seatbelts in my car, everyone will not think, well, they're thinking about the driver's safety. They will think the car must be unsafe. And so what the car manufacturers did was very intelligent. They all got together and went to Washington, D.C. and said, look, can you just make a quick law that says cars must have seatbelts? That way we all jump in together and we can make people safer and none of us has this reputational damage that people think their cars are unsafe or something. So that's what they did. They just used the law to force people to do what probably, well, obviously they should have done anyway, right? What's going on here with in the case of skin cancer, is you're doing some version of the same thing. You know, maybe we should just defer to the machine. But in the human circumstances as they are now, it's impossible. So we just make a law that says you have to defer to the machine, whether you like it or not. So that's the second solution. Fine. The third solution, and that's the one I want to talk about now briefly, is something called an explainable wrapper. And this, an AI German research center, DFKI, I don't know what that stands for, but D is probably Deutschland, right? Created this product XAID, which is explainable AI dermatology. And what that product does is that creates these colorations here. That's the result of the explainable AI wrapper. So how does it work? First, there's one artificial intelligence that looks at the skin lesion and gives you a diagnosis, cancer, not cancer. Then around that artificial intelligence, there is a second machine that looks at what the first one is doing and gives you a heat map that shows you what parts of the skin lesion are leading to the diagnosis which is produced. So it's a kind of interpretability, explainability or an interpretability machine. So it says, look, it's because of this blue part here. That's the part that makes the machine think that this is skin cancer. Or it looks like actually from this concept classification on the right, it's not the blue. It's actually the red parts, which are the problematic parts. So when you see the red parts, that's where they think they are indications of skin cancer. So then in that case, what the doctor can do is perhaps go back and look more carefully, him or herself, at the skin lesion and say, here, that's true. That's right. There is kind of a little bit of a kind of texture or something that might indicate it's not just a normal scar or something. Instead, it really is something that might indicate skin cancer. So then what this explainability wrapper does is, first it produces a result, then it helps the doctor go back and see why that result or that determination was produced. And that helps, right? Because now a doctor can say, look, I've got a reason for saying that this is skin cancer or this is not skin cancer. Still might be making a mistake. Still has error, of course. Machines make mistakes. Humans make mistakes, of course. But at least now, if the doctor makes a mistake, and you know, unfortunately, sometimes it happens, then the mistake will have mortal consequences. The doctor will say, that's not skin cancer, and the patient, and it will be skin cancer, and the patient will die. At least now, the doctor can go back and say, look, when I looked at it, I did look carefully at this, this, and this, and my professional conclusion was that it was not skin cancer. I was wrong, but I could show you why I came to the conclusion it did. It was a sincere conclusion. It was not a bad way of thinking. It was just the wrong answer. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes people have good decision processes, but they still come to the wrong decision. So there's the idea of explainable artificial intelligence. This is a real case. Is that idea that you can capture the accuracy of AI without just throwing up your hands and saying, well, we can't explain it, we just accept it. I mean, you can get the best of, or at least you can hope to get the best of both worlds. Now, we can't do that in every case. So the dilemmas about explainability versus accuracy, they're going to continue. But there are at least some cases where we can use technology to satisfy the human concern about the human dignity, let's say, of understanding why we are receiving the treatment we are, even if it's wrong, even if it has negative consequences. And then I have a quick note here. This is conventional versus acceleration AI ethics. I will just quickly note here what's going on in this slide is this idea that when we have these kinds of problems in AI ethics, like the explainability problem, there are two kinds of responses that are going on right now. One is called the slow AI movement. And that idea is that we should, in essence, slow down AI innovation, or we should just not use computers until we understand why they make the decisions they do. That's called slow AI. And that solves the explainability problem by saying, look, we're just going to slow down innovation. We're just not going to advance faster than we can understand ourselves the advances. On the other side, there's the idea of what's called acceleration ethics. And that's the idea that the way to solve the explainability problem and more generally other ethical problems that arise because of innovations, the way to solve those problems is to use the same innovative powers that caused the problem in the first place to resolve it. So if it was advanced AI technology that led to the problem that we could diagnose skin cancer but not explain it, we can use that same technology that those same engineers, that same kind of engineering, to leap forward and produce a solution to the problem, that is this AI wrapper, which tells us why the decision was made. So the question is, when we have an ethical dilemma, do we slow down or do we speed up? The acceleration response is we speed up. And we speed up because innovation itself will solve innovation's problems. Okay, that's some general background to stuff that's going on in AI debates now. But let's stick with explainability and the ethics there. We can take 5 minutes to hierarchize the three responses to the accountability gap, right? This one, eliminate the human, eliminate the machine, or the explainability, and evaluate those, sort of understand those in your own language. Okay, the next subject is forget explainability. What does that mean? That means, I mean, we've been saying up to now that explainability has this human value and we should have it, but that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you can make the argument, make an ethical argument, that you know what? It's not really a trade-off. It's not the case that we give away some explainability in favor of some accuracy, or maybe in favor of some social well-being, or in favor of some autonomy. It's not necessarily that. Maybe explainability just isn't a human value. This is a radical response. Maybe explainability doesn't matter. Maybe we don't need it. Maybe the true right example is not the cancer example or the car example. Maybe the true and revealing example, the paradigmatic case, is Netflix, where we say, we don't care how we got the right movie. I just care that it's the right movie. And who cares about the explainability? Maybe that's the way we should start to think in the face of these problems. Maybe we should just stop asking how and why the machine made the decision it did and only be concerned about how well it does what it does. And just say, look, if the machine does it better than a human, that's it. Not interested in explainability questions anymore. And there are two kinds of arguments to make here. These are arguments saying we should just forget about explainability. One is a practical argument made by many people, including a famous Carnegie Mellon professor, Manuela Veloso. And she says on this issue, she says, look, artificial intelligence is like microwave ovens. A lot of us don't understand exactly how microwave ovens work. Now, of course, in the case of microwave ovens, if we wanted to understand, we could, you know, I could go to Wikipedia or YouTube and ask for a video, and it probably would explain to me how microwave ovens work. But she's still right in the general sense that there are a lot of things, whether it's a microwave oven or the transmission in your car or TV reception or who knows what, there are a lot of things that we have around us, many, many, many things that we just don't understand. And we deal with it. We live that way. We, in some sense, we don't care, right? All I want is for the microwave to make my popcorn. I don't care how it does it. And if it stops working, if it fails to make the popcorn, I don't get mad. I don't start thinking, oh, I shouldn't have had some explainable reason for this. I just say, no, I'm going to get a different microwave. That's all. I don't care why. Maybe, you know, what she is saying is that artificial intelligence is like that. It's just a thing. And if it's working, we use it. If it's not working, we don't. That's it. We don't need to have any more questions. Another example of this is aspirin. I'm not sure if this is still true, but for many, many years, decades, we used aspirin, of course, to kill pain. But we did not know why it did what it did. I'm not sure how aspirin was discovered. It must have been some kind of accidental discovery, you know, tree bark. I think I read about it once. So it was discovered from tree bark or something. In any case, however it was discovered, for many, many years and decades, we used aspirin here in the West frequently, normally, without thinking about it, and we had no idea. Even the highest scientists had no idea why it did what it did. None. Did that stop us from using it? No. We said, look, as long as it does what it's supposed to do, I'm fine. If I get a headache and I take 3 aspirins and 4 and 5 and it doesn't cure the headache, well, maybe I stop taking aspirin and I go see a doctor or something. But as long as, you know, I have a headache and I take an aspirin and it goes away and it happens once in a while, who cares? And why? That's the argument she is making. She's saying, look, it happens all around us every day. There's all kinds of stuff that we don't understand and we don't care. And why should AI be any different? We should just put it in the same box as everything else. As long as the Tesla is not having accidents, I'm not going to start asking about why it does what it does. And then maybe, okay, so maybe it does have an accident sometime. Well, we'll just have to accept the fact that in those cases, she would say, or it seems like she would say, she would just say, in those cases, we're going to have to learn to live in a world where sometimes bad stuff happens, the Tesla has an accident, and it's no one's fault. Lightning strikes. It does happen. People are hit by lightning. It's no one's fault. Bad things happen. Not anyone's fault. We go on. AI should be like that. Makes sense. I suppose she would want to say practically that, look, the benefits are sufficient, right? There's so many benefits to the AI doing this that it's worth having this loss. So that's one argument. The argument is, there are two different ways of saying it. One way of saying it would be that explainability, all this stuff about human dignity, and it's important for me as a human to understand why things are happening to me. One argument is to say, not really. You're saying that, Brousseau, but it's not really true. And you can see that it's not true because you use microwave ovens, you use the Netflix stuff, and you don't care. So all this stuff about how important explainability is, that's all just hand-waving. It's not really true. So that's one practical argument. I guess the other way of making that practical argument is, even if it is true, it's still worth it to use the technology because it's not that big a deal. So you can take your pick, you know, whichever argument you like there. That's the practical argument. Now, there's also an epistemological argument. Epistemology is the study of how we think, or how we, the kind of the structures in the mind that shape or determine the kinds of things it's possible for us to think. Just like, let's say, my ears determine what kind of sensory reception I have here. Like, I have no sensory reception of color here, or of smell. I only have auditory reception here. And then my nose would be also no color. Like, I receive no information about the exterior world in terms of its color from my nose. I only get scent and so on. So something like that, the idea that your nose does certain stuff and your ears do certain things, something like that also applies to the mind. You can say, look, the way we think allows us to see certain things, but not see other things, right? So what this person is saying is that the way we think about reality, we should kind of switch from like noses to ears in a certain sense. He's saying we have been accustomed to thinking about reality in terms of explanations. We say, look, that's what it means to understand reality. He's making a kind of scientific claim here that, and I think it's clearly right, that what it means for you and I to understand something is to understand why it happened, the sort of causal effect. Like, well, why is it raining? It's raining because there was some humidity in the air, and the temperature dropped enough for that humidity in the air to condense as droplets. Then we call that process clouds. Clouds darkening, and then these droplets finally get so heavy that they fall out of the air. We call that rain. Good explanation. We understand why I'm getting wet. Okay, that's what it means. And we think scientifically to understand the world. Great. What he is saying is we should change the way we understand the world. We should just stop thinking that way. We should instead just accept the knowledge of the machines as knowledge. In other words, it's not so much that practically we get along without knowing why things happened, why something happened. Instead, what he's saying is, let's just imagine that knowledge itself is different. What it means now to have knowledge and what it means to be a human who seeks knowledge, what that means is no longer involved with cause and effect. It's no longer involved with understanding in the classical scientific sense. Instead, what it means to understand is nothing more and nothing less than understanding the accuracy of the machine. If it works, we use it. If it doesn't, we don't. That's what understanding means. Understanding does not mean understanding the gears inside. So what he is proposing is that we just change the way our minds work. We change how we understand the word understand. So it's not just a practical claim that explanations don't matter. It's instead the idea itself that knowledge is no longer about explanations. Knowledge is about accuracy. It's about knowing how well the machine works. And as it happens, we won't go too deep in this, but this brings us to very deeply into my world of the history of philosophy. This debate has already happened in the 18th century. Kant versus Hume. Hume was I believe he was Scottish, though possibly English. Kant was a Prussian or a German. And Kant said, in essence, what scientists today say. He said, look, understanding something means understanding it in terms of cause and effect. Hume was kind of a skeptic about all that. Hume said, look, you know, I hear people talking about cause and effect all the time, but I've never actually seen a cause. I see the effects, right? If you hit one billiard ball against another, I see the second one rolling away. So I see effects. But I never see exactly a cause. I mean, I see one ball hitting and then another ball going. But do we see some thing moving from one ball to the other? I mean, it's hard to say exactly what the cause is. It just seems like there's two balls and first one is moving, then the other is moving. And every time I see one ball here and another ball hits it, then that same thing happens. So what Hume wants to say is, look, when we look carefully at our experience, what we actually perceive is kind of like what computers have. We actually just perceive this constant correspondence. When one ball runs into another one, the second one goes somewhere, right? That effect. But we don't actually see kind of the actual cause. It's not like some little white thing called a cause moves from one ball to the other, right? We just see this constant replication of the same pattern. So Hume was against Kant, and Hume sort of said, look, basically, we just have to figure that what we consider understanding is sort of a kind of a myth or kind of a fairy tale. This idea of cause and effect and causality and the way scientists think, it's really just kind of an invention that we've made up to help us feel more comfortable in the world, but it's not true. What's true, when we actually look at what happens on the pool table over and over again, is we make conclusions about what will happen just by creating patterns that summarize what we have seen in the past. Like one white ball hits another ball, the white ball goes slower and the other ball goes faster. We just see it. We've seen it many, many times. The pattern is there. So I think when I hit this white ball here, it will impact the other ball. What will happen again is that the other ball will start moving. I won't ever see a cause. I won't ever see some thing like go from one ball to the other. All I'm really doing is just saying it happened before, so it's going to happen again. Now, that's pretty much the way computers work, right? That's what a computer says. A computer says, look, over and over again, I've seen this kind of blemish in the skin, and it's been cancer. So I see the blemish again, therefore it's cancer. Why is it cancer? I don't know. It's just that pattern repetition, nothing else. So there's no explanation to it. Right? We only care about the constant correspondence of one thing with another. We only care about the repetition of the pattern. And that way of understanding the world is completely different than the Kantian way or the cause and effect way, where we say, well, look for the gears and say, well, it's because this, you keep going down and down. It's because this color indicates some number of this cell, and because this cell indicates some pathogen, and because this pathogen indicates da da da. Right, we keep going until we kind of get tired and we say, okay, that's enough. we have the cause. We've got it all explained. We can say why we have cancer. Someone like Hume says, yeah, forget all that. All you need to see is that every time you see this color on the skin, you get cancer out. So let's just take that knowledge. Do we end up wrong sometimes because it's never every time? Yes, we do. Sometimes we're wrong. But we should just accept that. That's the way the world is. So for Hume says, look, computers are actually closer to true knowledge than humans are. But Kant and Kant represents the way most humans think today. What humans tend to say is, well, no, not really. Humans really understand and think. Computers don't. But it's possible to make the argument, and that's the argument that's being made here. It's possible to make the argument that this is a Tesla accident, and the U.S. government Department of Transportation explained there may not be a causal connection between the human programmer and the end result. Basically saying, look, there isn't causality. Just one thing happens and then another. That's it. That's all we know. So this idea of explainability, as it's usually understood in terms of causality, this idea of explainability, we're just going to have to learn to live without it. And we're going to have to learn to live without it as an epistemological argument, because that's the way truth is for humans now. It's different than it was during the Industrial Age. During the Industrial Age, what truth meant was understanding cause and effect. But during the Digital Age, what truth means, and this is an epistemological argument, what truth means will no longer be about cause and effect. Truth will only be about just accuracy, 90%, 70%, 99%, what have you. Not about understanding why it's right or wrong. It's only about understanding how right or wrong it is. That's what it means to have knowledge. Say that. Okay. And then one last point here. One approach to this question about whether or not we should have explainability. The question we're asking here is explainability worth having? And we started out with the assumption that it is worth having. And that is the assumption that is most active in artificial intelligence ethics today. But we're questioning it here. We're saying, look, maybe it's just not worth having at all. And if that's the case, then we don't need to worry about it. One way to approach this huge, big question is to ask ourselves, well, what is artificial intelligence like? What does it resemble? I mean, is it like aspirin? Is it like a microwave drug oven? Is it like something else? Maybe that will help us define whether or not we should ask artificial intelligence to be explainable. Okay, so you can take 5 minutes to think about that. Okay, now we're going to talk about some practical things. That is, let's assume that we want explainability. That's a good thing. What are some practical impediments to it? I mean, why don't we have it? There are a few. One, and I think the most important one is, we've been talking about this indirectly throughout the entire seminar, really, is that the more sophisticated and complicated and, yes, accurate an artificial intelligence is, in general, this is not true every time, but in general, the more accurate and effective it is, the less we're able to explain it. This is just a practical truth. Right? The better the machine, the less we can explain it. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, right, if you and I, we just can't keep up, if the machine is so smart that we just can't understand it, then maybe what we should say is, look, it's our bad. We just can't keep up. That's all. But we're better off having these better machines. So if you go to people out in the world, you just ask someone on the sidewalk, you tell them, look, the practical reality is, if we want the machine to perform better, we're not going to be able to understand it. A lot of people are just going to say, well, that's the way it goes. That's the practical truth. I'd prefer to have the better machine than have the explanation. So that's the first just practical impediment to explainability. It's the fact that, at least so far, the machine works better if we don't demand explainability. Maybe that will change in the future, but right now that's the case. Another set of practical problems are that the idea is it's not just that the machine works better. There's this idea of the black box nature. You could say that maybe it's just part of the nature of how AI works that it's not explainable. Right? So it's beyond the fact that the good ones are not explainable. Now we're expanding that a little bit and just saying, well, because artificial intelligence is this neural network, this mess of connections that no human being could ever keep up with, not even close, not remotely close, maybe it's just the nature of the machine to not be explainable. Another reason why it can be hard to get explainability in artificial intelligence is because if people do understand why it works, they don't want to tell you. And the reason they don't want to tell you is because that's kind of the secret sauce, right? That's what they have. That's the advantage they have as the owner of the technology. If they develop the technology and they know why and how it works, they want that secret, that trade secret, to remain so that other people cannot imitate their technology. And that makes perfect sense, right? If I spend a lot of years developing an artificial intelligence, even if I understand perfectly why it works, I don't want you to understand, because then you will just take my idea and make money off my idea. I want to make money on my idea, not have you. I don't mean you personally, but I mean, you know, whoever, some other people out there. If I want, and that seems legitimate to me, if I put a lot of work into making an idea, I should get the reward for it. So it makes sense that I try and keep secret exactly how it works. This is true for Coca-Cola and everything, right? I mean, Coca-Cola, I'm not sure, maybe now we know, but for a long time, Coke tried to keep their recipe secret. So like, we don't want other people to know because we don't want them to copy our product. And then a third reason, a practical impediment to explainability, is kind of a version of the intellectual property rights. It's this idea that, well, if you're making an autonomous car like a Tesla, you are bringing together a lot of parts from a lot of different manufacturers, and some of those parts have their independent artificial intelligence. Like, for example, if you have a Tesla that has cameras that detect what is going on in front of the car, behind and beside, but let's say in front of the car, then that information is sent to another AI that says, okay, if that's a human there, then we better stop, and so on. But maybe that the artificial intelligence, which is in the camera, and that recognizes that's a human, that's a car, that's a tree, that stuff, right? Maybe that AI is not made by Tesla. Maybe that artificial intelligence is made by the camera maker, and Tesla just buys it and then combines the results from that AI with the AI that Tesla itself makes, which drive the car. So if there's this integration of third-party products, again, that might be that company doesn't want to reveal how their machine works, or maybe Tesla just doesn't have the time to track it down. And so that's another practical reason why it can be hard to explain how a Tesla or many artificial intelligence technologies work. Again, because they're bringing together multiple AIs from different sources. And then finally, there is a real important theoretical impediment to explainability. And that is, when we talked about interpretability, like in the loan case, we said, look, maybe we can show that it's because you didn't make your credit card payments that you did not get the loan. So maybe we can say that, and this is what we're getting a little bit technical here, but people who pursue explainability, one thing they do is they use something called Shapley values. What Shapley values are is they are attempts, or, well, I think that there's some success. And what they do is they try to attribute to various input pieces of data which one of those input pieces of data played the largest role in determining what the output was. So in the case of my loan application, which was rejected, if we determine it was rejected because I did not pay my credit card bills, then probably the Shapley value would show, if there was a kind of map like this, it would show that the credit card information was very red. It was very high. It was a big input to the output decision that I was refused this loan. Fine. But there's an assumption there. There's a metaphor there. The assumption is that the thing that has the biggest input is most responsible for the output. But that's not necessarily true. And I'm thinking here, the example I have in my mind is cooking. Sometimes in cooking, a very little bit of one ingredient can make a very large difference in the taste of the dish. Let's say you're making mashed potatoes or something. Well, the biggest ingredient is the mashed potatoes, no doubt, of course. But maybe just a little bit of one ingredient, I'm not a cook, so I don't know, but just one ingredient could really change the taste of that potatoes. And it's maybe that one little ingredient that makes it very tasty and makes it very successful for a restaurant. So if what a Shapley value is doing is, it's saying that the way we explain AI is by finding that piece of data that had the biggest role in making, in forming the conclusion. Maybe that's not true. Maybe the strategy we have for creating explainability is not a good strategy. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe AI is like cooking, and it's just some tiny little ingredient which looks just like a tiny thing, but that's making all the difference. Or maybe not. The problem is we don't know. It's a big problem. So there are these impediments to explainability. There's the practical impediments, and then there is this theoretical impediment. And it's different from what we talked about in the last step, where we said, look, even if there's not an impediment of that kind, maybe we don't care about explainability anyway. Now we're saying, even if we do care about explainability, we still have these big problems in trying to get it. So you can kind of answer for yourself, I think, this question about whether AI is like cooking. At least you can kind of answer theoretically in your mind. I don't think any of us know the answer to that. Okay, and so now we are coming to the end, the last set of ideas, and this is the idea of redress. Okay, redress is the imposition of accountability. That is, it's one thing to say there is accountability. We know who caused the Tesla accident. Redress is the idea that there is the possibility of acting on that knowledge. Right? Redress is the idea that accountability does not just exist theoretically. We know who's to blame or who deserves the credit, but we have the ability to actually impose some kind of penalty or some kind of benefit, depending upon whether it's blame or credit, depending upon whether the machine failed or succeeded. These are almost more legal debates surrounding AI as much as ethical, but just very quickly, we will kind of strap these on at the end. That if you're studying law at all, this is and will be a very rich area of investigation. I mean, rich in terms of intellectually stimulating, but probably also a good way to make money because there's going to be a lot of cases in this area in the future. A lot of cases that will be about trying to figure out when AI goes wrong, beyond just who is at fault, you know, what kind of penalty or what kind of benefit should be attributed to this or that case. And there are some strategies. I say that there are three, but it looks like there are actually four on the list for this, for redress, for actually applying accountability. You know, one is the idea of the learned intermediary. The idea here, and again, this is more of a legal idea than an ethical idea. The idea here is that whoever is in charge of the artificial intelligence, whoever that might be, that person is the one responsible for what the AI does, regardless of why what happens happens. So in the case of Tesla, the person who's in the car, even if he or she has it on autopilot and is playing with his or her phone, this person is still the learned intermediary. This is the person who acts between the AI and the world And this person is therefore responsible for what happens. So if I'm playing on my phone when the car has an accident, it doesn't matter if it's the AI malfunctioning that had caused that accident. I am the learned intermediary. I am the one in charge of overseeing. I am on the loop of the AI, so to speak. I am overseeing how it's functioning. So I'm the one who is accountable and responsible. And if you're going to sue someone, or if money should be paid to a victim, I'm the one that should pay it, not the designer of the AI. Even if the AI made a wrong decision, because I'm the person who was in control of the AI at the time, I am the learned intermediary. It's my legal fault. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. And Tesla actually functions within that theory, because Tesla, part of their rules for the use of the autopilot is that you keep your hands on the wheel at all time. That's an explicit rule. And they do that for legal reasons. They do that because they want to impose the idea of the learned intermediary. They want to say that regardless of what our AI does, if you're the driver in the car, it's your fault. That makes sense. I mean, it makes sense because to a certain degree, yes, of course, if you're the driver in the car, you should be paying attention to what's going on, just like the pilot in an airplane or the engineer in a train. So yeah, it is your fault. Even if the machine makes a mistake, you're supposed to be on top of that. You're supposed to be watching that. So it's the driver's fault. The problem with this theory, or the problem with this approach, is that the reason you get the Tesla driverless car is not so that you as the driver can sit there like watching all the time, and then you might as well just drive yourself. The reason you get the Tesla driverless car is so that you can text on the highway. That's why you get it. That's the point of it. That's why we have it. So if that's why we have it, if that's the point, then this whole idea of the learned intermediary, it kind of stops making sense. We should just say, in that case, we should just say, well, no AI in cars, right? If we're going to say the driver is responsible, we should just say, forget artificial intelligence in cars, because it serves no purpose. If we're going to allow artificial intelligence in cars, then we kind of have to allow drivers to play on their phones, since that's the point. And if we have to allow drivers to play on their phones or take a nap or whatever, and then we need a different strategy for redress. We need someone else to get sued. So you can you can make your own decisions upon that. But on the one side, the idea of the learned intermediary, it makes good sense. If the driver is there, he or she is supposed to be watching what's going on. On the other hand, what's the point of the AI if the driver can't take a nap? Another theory is that the human creator should be the one, I mean, of the artificial intelligence, should be the one who is responsible when things go wrong or right. So in this case, if there's the Tesla accident, it's the person who originally programmed the AI. That's the person. And that makes sense too, right? I mean, the person who originally made the programming also controls the degree to which that programming will be affected by the driver's own decisions. So ultimately, really, it is the original programmer who has the most control over what will happen. So he or she should inherit the most responsibility and the need to pay or the benefit if things go wrong or right, right? Because that's the origin of it. That's where the most control exists. And I think that's pretty clear. The person who has most control over what the Tesla will do in driverless mode is the person who designed the AI that exists in the car when it leaves the shop. That's the person who has the most potential to control what happens. So therefore, maybe that's the person who should be sued if things go wrong, or gets a bonus if things go right. One problem with this is, and we've already discussed this, is that the AI in these cars now, it is beginning, we are increasingly using AI that learns from the driver. And that does, again, we just keep going back to the same problem. When the AI learns from the driver, that's good. It gets better at driving. But now we have higher performance, higher accuracy, but less accountability. Because if it's learning from me, now we don't know if me, the driver, is at fault or the original designer. We get a better car. We get fewer accidents. But when we get those accidents, we have less ability to understand who should be blamed. So the human creator also has problems. It makes sense. The creator is the one who has the most control. But it kind of defeats the purpose of maximizing the capacity of the AI. A third way, and this is just inherited from the industrial economy, a third way is just the idea of legal personhood for the AI. So who's responsible when the Tesla has an accident? Well, Tesla is responsible. But not the human being, Elon Musk, or not the human being who designed the AI. Instead, the company, the corporation. So if the car makes a mistake and causes an accident, and no one goes to jail because there's no person involved, the only thing we can do as far as redress goes, as far as imposing a penalty, the only thing we can do is have the company pay money. That's it. That has worked to some extent in the industrial economy. It works because it allows innovation. It allows companies to try new things, since if it goes off the tracks, no one is really to blame. So that's good. It's good as long as it works. It's good as long as it produces innovation. The problem is, and this here in this in the world of AI is just the same problem we had in business ethics 50 years ago, is that, well, it seems unsatisfying if people are harmed, something goes wrong, people die because of a machine, and the most we can do is say it's the company's fault. We should sue General Motors. And if we win, if we say it, we've proved it's their fault, all we get is money. No human being ever suffers. That seems very unsatisfying. But it is a deal that we have made in the industrial economy, and we can make it again here in the AI economy too. We can say, look, if the Tesla causes an accident and someone dies, it's Tesla, the company, that's at fault. But that means there's no one to go to jail. It's just money. It's just money. That's it. But money is real too. I mean, I don't like to lose money. And to some extent, money does pay for damages. I mean, if, for example, if I'm in a Tesla and I have an accident and I break my finger and Tesla pays me $1 million for that, yeah, I feel like that's okay. I'll take that deal. I don't need to blame any human being. I'll take $1 million for a broken finger. Money, I don't want to be dismissive of money. Money works. It just doesn't work when someone dies. So just like all these strategies, they are imperfections. Okay, and then the final response or redress strategy is something called redress by design, which is, as I note here, a form of explainability. That is, you simply design the artificial intelligence so that, right from the start, we can figure out who is responsible. Basically, what we're saying here is that we just insist that artificial intelligence be explainable. It's kind of that slow AI option where we say, look, we're just not going to allow artificial intelligence to exist in the world until we can explain how it works, and therefore attribute errors and successes to the person who created that part of the AI. That makes sense. We could do that. The problem, though, is that we're losing accuracy, or we're just losing the technology, right? If we say we can't allow the technology to exist in the world until it is explainable, a lot of stuff, like, for example, those cancer diagnostic tools, a lot of them are going to disappear. Now, we can keep some of them because we've learned how to explain how they work, but there are others that we will lose. Lives will be lost because tools we have that could diagnose skin cancer are not available for use because we can't blame anybody when something goes wrong. Are we willing to accept that? Maybe. In any case, what is certain is that if redress is important to you, if it's not enough to say just that some company's to blame, but some one person, a human being, really should bear the blunt of the blame when something goes wrong, and also, of course, be accorded the benefit when something goes right. If it's really important that there be some attributable, or some human should gain or suffer because of what the machine does, then redress by design is a good solution. Say, look, we just won't allow AI to work in the world until we know who is to blame when it goes wrong or right. And then here's another example of redress by design. It's a little bit different. The idea could be that, we will just look at it. So what the person here says is essentially there should be a default setting in this case. This is copyright. And if you can use artificial intelligence, and YouTube, let me step back for a second. YouTube uses artificial intelligence to detect when someone uploads a video. I mean, trillions of videos are being uploaded every second. That's an exaggeration, but not much. All these videos are being uploaded every second onto YouTube. We would have to have every human in the world constantly watching videos if we were going to check and see whether music was being used in these videos that was used without permission from the Rolling Stones or something. And so what YouTube does is they use AI to locate videos that have this music, like, let's say, a Rolling Stones song, like a Rolling Stone, right? My famous Stone song. It's on this video. AI has found it, and therefore YouTube will reject this video or not allow it to be monetized or something. Now, the problem is when you've got these AIs doing that, is that there's no, and the AI is wrong, there's no redress. I mean, you can find this out for yourself. Put up a video which it makes us with a song that sounds a lot like a classic, like Beatles' Hey Jude or Rolling Stones, something like that. Something which is sure to be caught by the copyright machine at YouTube. But make it just sufficiently different so it really is your own song. You will find out that probably it will be flagged and blocked by YouTube. And then if you get that far, then try to get YouTube to put it back on, you know, by writing them letters saying, look, this song is different in this way. So it really is original. So it should be good. Good luck with that. Good luck. You know, YouTube just says, forget it. I mean, once anyone who's had this experience with YouTube, I have had it many times with my videos. For one reason or another, it gets flagged. And I've said, look, no, it should not be flagged for that. For example, in my stuff, because I have a lot of ethics videos, I talk about a lot of things like, that are quite controversial. We'll talk about abortion, talk about capital punishment. And I will use a case study where I will say someone murders someone else. In some of these videos, it just gets the right keywords. It detects that I'm talking about murder or something. And maybe I'm pretending, right? Maybe in this video, I will pretend like I'm a hitman and I will say I do this, but I'm paid for this. And so is this justifiable? I say all kinds of crazy stuff. And then YouTube says, well, look, this person apparently is a hitman murdering people, so we're not going to allow his video up. Take it down. And then I try to write YouTube a letter and say, no, it's okay. It's just ethics. Don't worry. I'm not actually going to kill anybody. Well, good luck with that. Right. I will never get through to a human being. I will never get that video up. I just have to put it on Vimeo instead or something. Right. In that case, YouTube is doing they're providing a free service, so I can't complain too much. But it is true that I'm being harmed to some extent by YouTube there. And there's just no redress. There's nothing I can do about it. What this person is proposing here is, well, it should go the other way. It should be that I should be able to appeal and say, look, this video goes up, and now the burden of proof is on YouTube to come down and tell me, look, now we can prove that it really was you really are a hitman, or it really was Rolling Stone song that you used, and therefore you should pay. And so in that case, if it's discovered that I used copyright material, then maybe YouTube could sue me or something. But what this person is proposing here is that the burden of proof be switched to YouTube. And that's this redress by design strategy, which maybe works, right? So, I mean, I could say, I put up the YouTube video, YouTube writes back, nope, can't do it because it's got a Rolling Stones song. I write back, check the box, objection, and it necessarily goes back up. And then I write in, it's not a Rolling Stones song. I wrote the song, it's different. And then if YouTube wants to later on, they can come back and check and sue me in court and take it down and so on. In other words, again, the burden shifts to YouTube from me. Okay, that is a kind of redress by design, right? The AI or the information technology is set in a way that I have an appeal. I can get the video put back up. But the problem with that is that everyone, of course, the bad guys are going to check the box and say, no, it's my song, when it really is the Rolling Stones song, and put it back up. So this redress by design kind of defeats the whole purpose. Because the reason they started using the AI in the first place was so that the Rolling Stones songs would not be used without permission. If I can just check a box that it is used, well, that doesn't work. So it's very, very difficult. The fact that we can't, we want these tools to work for us, but the fact that it's so hard to explain frequently why the YouTube algorithm classified my song as a Rolling Stones song when it wasn't, and classified this other song as not a Rolling Stones song when it is, it's so hard to figure out why that happened that it's just really difficult to say who should be blamed for this. And that's kind of what we have been talking about now for the last many slides. Just very quickly here, we're nearly the end. The European Union or European Community ethics guidelines for trustworthy AI do talk about the redress in AI systems, and they believe that for the European mainstream ethical stance, explainability is a value; it is worth having, and they are closer to the slow AI camp than the innovation camp. And what they will say is, AI systems should be explainable, one. And two, explainability means there should be a way for users to contest decisions, to say, this is wrong. There should be a way for users to make a claim for harm done, to say, this is wrong, and I deserve $5 because it was wrong. And then available information about how to make the claim, there should be a way, once I've decided that, there should be a way for me to know how to make that claim. And then available, I'm not sure exactly what that last point is, but basically what the EC guidelines say is that the company YouTube is responsible. If it's going to use AI, they have to set up a way for me to dispute their findings. That makes sense. It's good. The idea that explainability is worth having makes sense. It's good. But again, you can't avoid the problem that if you force YouTube to do that, then they lose a lot of the value of their AI. And if you really force them, the EC makes these rules and then they don't enforce them, so they don't matter. But if they were really enforced, YouTube would have to shut down, because it can't do that. It just can't. That's the reality. And that actually has happened. A few things have happened like that in Europe. Companies have just said, well, we're leaving because we can't play by your rules. Does that mean the rules are bad? No. Does that mean that the Europeans are making the wrong decision? No. But it certainly means that it's really hard to get both. If you want explainability and you want the very best AI, you're going to have a hard time. So you've got to make a decision. Okay. So you could just take some time to think about the redress strategies. This is what we have talked about. We've defined what explainability is. We've defined the idea that explainability is important for accountability and redress. We've said that there is a practical. Well, first we'll say there's a theoretical idea that maybe you could say explainability doesn't matter. Of course, in counter to that, we had the original examples where we said explainability does matter. And then that's a theoretical question. Then there's the practical question. Well, how much explainability? How much accuracy? Where do we draw the line? And then there's the questions kind of repeat in this area of redress, which is more a legal consideration than an ethical one. But it's a very real area of AI ethics. If you want the questions about AI explainability and accuracy, if you want to see how they work in real life, a very good place to look is in the legal debates surrounding redress for AI when something goes wrong. Okay, I think that's enough for today.